Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Lapointe Event Group conference call. I will now turn the call over to David Lapointe Event. Please go ahead.
Thanks, operator. Welcome to the call. I think this is actually an important one. I have with me on the call my co-portfolio managers, Mark Rinfret, Fletcher Hemmings, and Darcy Crowe. And Aaron Hoffman on research is away today, so he's not on the call, but I'm sure he will dial in. Okay, so what I want to talk to you about today is what's been happening in the bond market. And the good news is we don't own bonds, and we have exited the bond market, and I've been talking to you guys about it. But the bonds in the last week and a bit have had their largest plunge in value. So if you own a bond, a government bond, and you go to sell it, the weekly plunge is the biggest in a decade. And from their lows of 2016, we've seen, for example, the five-year Canada bond go from 0.47% just over 2 years ago to 2.5%, which is a stunning move in a very short period of time. So what I want to talk about is this potential that Jim Grant of the Grant's Interest Rate Observer has pointed out, and that is that we've had in some of your lifetimes, and if you're retired now, you might know this cycle, but we've had two enormous interest rate super cycles. And the first one started at the end of World War II in 1946. And that cycle ended in 1981, and that was a period of rising inflation and rising interest rates. And the second cycle, and that was exactly 35 years, and the second cycle started in 1981, and I can remember I bought a $100 Canada savings bond at a 19.5% interest rate in 1981. U.S. 10-year yields hit 16. We were at a premium to the United States. And that was the peak of interest rates. And so that 31-year cycle ended in July of 2016. So we had 35 years of rising rates and falling bond yields and 35 years of declining interest rates. And, you know, it's interesting in the 1946 to 1981, I'll characterize some of the characteristics of what was going on at the time. So the Federal Reserve, we had just exited the Depression, remember, in the 30s, which was characterized by deflation, massive prices, and high unemployment rate. So in that period of time, the Fed was very worried about deflation. We were running large deficits. So think about the World War II. We continued with massive deficits. That period was characterized by trade barriers and tariffs, and it was also characterized by low unemployment and a scarcity of labor. Is it starting to sound familiar to today's environment? I have a quote from Richard Nixon in 1972 that he prefers the Fed to keep interest rates low. Concerns about the... This is a quote, concerns about too much liquidity are just bullshit. This is according to Richard Nixon. And now we have a president who is running deficits, trade barriers, and we also have an unemployment rate that hit its lowest level since 1969 at 3.7%, and we're starting to see the same scarcity of labor. So if we are entering another 35-year super cycle, and I'll tell you if I'm right in the 2050 Lapointe & Group conference call. But if we are entering that, there's a lot of similarities, and those could be reversed, but the similarities are quite shocking. In 1946 to 1981, the worst place to be, worst, was in cash over that period of time. And in cash, you know, the cost of living during that time, money depreciated by 93%. In other words, the cost of living went up more than tenfold during that period. And so therefore, if you were rolling savings bonds or short-term GICs, you lost, even adjusted for inflation. So money in a safety deposit box lost 93% of its value. Money in interest-bearing assets lost 40% of its value. And that's not spending any money. Now, if you include taxation, you lost 60% of your wealth in cash. So I go from call to call on people saying, I want to go to cash or I want to be in bonds. Now, bonds had a similar return. In fact, the returns were slightly less in the bond market because we had a period of interest rates rising, therefore falling bonds. So there was many, many, not just earning 2%. I mean, think about a period of time in 1958 where, again, they're still worried about deflation. Inflation hit 8% and interest rates were still just over 2%. So in that period of time, you know, it took 10 years from rates to go from 2.25% to 3.25%. And in this cycle, it's taken just 2 years to go from 2.25% to 3.25%. So the implications are quite striking. Now, there's two sides to inflation. One is rising interest rates changes the value of a income stream. And when you buy a stock and you buy General Mills that makes Cheerios and Yoplait, or you buy a telecommunications company, you're buying an income stream. So if as you are with, say, a commercial property. So if you're buying commercial property and it's rented out for $100,000 a year, well, what's the value of that commercial property? Well, I have to say, well, what are the interest rates? If interest rates are 10%, that commercial property might be worth $1 million. But if interest rates are 2%, it might be worth $50 million because that's how much you get at the bank. Now, the other side of it is in inflation, you tend to be able to raise your rents by 5% a year, say, at least with inflation. And the same held true in the stock market because from 1946 to 1981, the Dow Jones Industrial Average actually averaged 9.13%. It was 5.0% inflation, so the good news was you still made 4% after inflation in stocks. The return from 1981 and the magic of falling interest rates and increasing the value of income streams was 12.4% from 1981 to the bottom of interest rates in July of 2016, which was an inflation-adjusted return of 9%, which was really unprecedented in stock market history, where inflation was just about 3% over that time. I mean, it's very interesting. I was telling the team, when I started in the business in the 80s, every single financial plan I ever read had, well, inflation is 5. That was the inflation expectation. Even though inflation was higher, we said, well, it'll probably come down to 5%. Now every financial plan I read has 2% inflation, and that is actually not the norm. The norm is that inflation goes much higher. So, you know, the danger of being overly conservative is someone who is 65 who have a life expectancy of the second to die of about 26 years. 26 years of being overly conservative with your cash could be a disaster. It certainly was in the time of that super cycle, the first super cycle of rising rates and rising inflation. So, you know, that's where we are. You know, the stock market now is waking up to the reality that interest rates are rising. And, you know, as such, just looking at the indices for the year, the TSX minus 3.7, the Dow is just 5.1 year to date. U.S. midterm bonds are minus 7, and Canadian midterm bonds are minus 3.8 year to date. So there hasn't been a lot to hide in. European markets are down about 9%. Asian markets are down about 22%. So there hasn't been a lot to hide in. But we're still certainly beating cash, and actually, if we look historically, A few months ago, people were worried about the flattening yield curve, and ironically, rising rates mean the yield curve is steepening, which again, yield curve is the difference between short-term rates and long-term rates. There is zero indicators in the United States of saying that there's an imminent recession. So, you know, if we look at Tony Dwyer's work, who was on the last call, he talks about credit cracks, and there's none of those. This is a stock market that is just worried. Now, again, this was not a stock market that the LaPointe Group was really liking at the beginning of the year, where the highest flying stocks were marijuana stocks, Amazon, and Netflix, which were all characterized by no profits, extremely high valuations, and no dividends. And ironically, you know, clients were phoning, why aren't we doing better? And ironically, in this market, we've got new highs in Verizon today. We've got Southern Company up. We've got Procter & Gamble up. These are our income streams. The market is returning to actually some sanity, which I like. And so, you know, in the market last month, if we look at the September, we might have been down a smidge, and we might be up this month. We also had a rally in the Canadian dollar. And ironically, somebody asked me, if NAFTA goes through, what do I think the Canadian dollar will go to? And I said 78 cents, and it went to just over 78 cents. And the Canadian dollar now is back below 77, and that's because the NAFTA concerns are behind us. And at the end of the day, rising interest rates is going to negatively affect Canada much harder than the United States, because our collective, especially household debt, is much higher than it is in the United States. That kind of concludes what I wanted to talk about today, and I'm happy to have conversations with clients one-on-one. I will read, there was a number of questions that were very, very similar, and so I'm going to read one of them. And it says, right now many indicators are positive, like the booming stock market. It must have been written about a week ago. Consumer confidence at 18-year highs, U.S. economy growing, etc. On the other hand, record U.S. deficits and record U.S. debt are not making headlines. One day, this has to give. When is the current boom bust? How fast could that happen? One indicator you're watching indicates that the correction is imminent. Again, corrections are corrections, and we've been through many, many corrections in the last 10 years together as we've held our stocks and clearly outperformed cash and bonds. The indicators we talk about are cracks in credit, valuations on stocks, and to be honest, with the stock market up 5, corporate profits are up north of 20, the valuation of the market has actually gotten better, not worse. So we're trading at about a 17 price earnings multiple, which equates to just over a 5.5% earnings yield, so earnings over price. So as interest rates rise, we need to get interest rates north of 4 before stocks become expensive. There's typically about a 1% differential against stocks because of the inherent risk of stocks. So interest rates are rising, which is a concern, but they haven't risen enough to warrant a massive exodus out of people's stocks like Verizon and Procter & Gamble, which still out-yield bonds and out-yield, but there's also an inflation component. Look, the price of Tide is going to go up in the long run. The price of Cheerios is going to go a lot higher, just as it has gone higher in the last 50 years. So if I have to buy an income stream, I could buy a 30-year Government of Canada bond today at 2.59%, or I could buy Procter & Gamble with a dividend yield of 3.5%. I'm going to take Procter & Gamble because I'm pretty sure the price of Tide is going to go up. I mean, it's also amazing to me that interest rates in Canada, we have a government official inflation rate of 2.8, and yet we have 30-year bonds yielding less than inflation. So interest rates have risen dramatically, but they're still not what they call normal. And so therefore, the outlook for bonds is still quite miserable. I want to meet the guy who is buying bonds. And in fact, as I mentioned before, one of the big reasons I had to leave the bank was a They want all their advisors to create zombie portfolios where you have to own 40% of your portfolio in bonds. Now, in the period of deflation, every stock market decline was characterized by bonds rising. This is a very interesting development in the last couple of years because bond prices are falling, and bonds are a terrible hedge against falling stocks because it's actually falling bonds which is creating concern on the market. So if you've got bonds, you are losing money. I ran into another advisor in the elevator yesterday who said, oh, I'm worried about my balance funds. And, you know, again, 2.1% in management fee, and you got 50% of the portfolio losing 3%, so you're at minus 5 on the 40% that's in the bond market. It's going to be very tough, and you've got the Canadian stock market down. I mean, I said to Mark Rinford this morning, in 10 years, I believe that balance funds will not even be an asset class that exists because the outlook for balance funds is pretty much a zero or negative return. You can almost take that to the bank in the next decade. So that kind of concludes it. It's going to be a tougher environment. I think this is a very important call. It's not as simple as running to cash. We will be increasing our cash. This is a typical October volatility. Let's look at November and December. The market is still going to look at strong economic growth in the United States. And what happens is the reason that November through to the end of January is the single strongest period of the stock market in the 12-month cycle is because people are positioning their portfolios. Every market strategist, every bank, every financial institution comes out with a forecast for the coming year. And people are going to not favor bonds, they're not going to favor cash, and people are going to start to make projections for the stock market for 2019, and that'll all of a sudden everyone starts positioning for their move to 2019. That being said, in 2019 we will probably begin to exit and get more defensive. We're not there yet. As I mentioned, rising interest rates has signaled the end of every stock market, and I don't mean corrections, I mean major cycles. We're not there yet. The yield curve has not inverted, and valuations on stocks, I've seen three market peaks, three recessions in my 32-year career, and every one of those, the Dow and the S&P, have peaked at over 20 times earnings over 30 times in 99. So the stock market is well under that and only marginally more expensive than history. And the stocks that we're buying are shockingly cheaper than the market as a whole. I do have some other questions that weren't necessarily appropriate for a lot of the questions were answered in the course of my comments. I might email some of you back, but I would also, operator, open that up for a few quick questions if we had any.
All right, so just to remind everyone to ask a question, you can press 01. We'll just give everyone a few minutes to queue up. Again, to ask a question, it's 01. Okay, we do have a few lining up. Just give us a few moments to capture the names.
It doesn't matter, operator, you can just put them on.
Okay, it won't be long.
Operator, it doesn't matter about the names, you can just put
Yeah, the problem is that if I don't have a name, I won't know how to refer to them to let them know. But, you know, we can try. So, yeah, go ahead with the question. Whoever asked, whoever wanted to ask the question.
Yeah.
All right. It won't be long. Just a second.
Oh, is that 01?
Yeah, okay. You're on the line now, so please ask your question.
Good morning, Dave. It's Lenora Gates calling. Always nice to hear your comments. I noticed that today you didn't touch on real estate at all, and I just wondered what your thoughts are, both as a BC market, as a nationwide market, what your thoughts are.
Awesome question. Thanks, Len. I guess I've been negative for so long. Again, why would anyone ask my opinion of real estate? But look, as you and I both know, West Van real estate and West Side market, the high end of BC has gone no bid. We are at 30-year lows on volume, and prices are really down probably 25% and dropping. That's going to have implications. We saw already housing starts in Canada fall from estimate of 210,000 to 188,000. Developers, we're now seeing weakness in the condo market. So the reason I touch on this is because Ontario market is not collapsing like BC, but higher rates are going to be a problem. We had mortgage rates in July of 2016, five-year mortgages at major chartered banks at 239. We're at 284 today, and that's a dramatic change. That's almost a 50% increase in the actual level of the market. That's people with million-dollar mortgages are going to be suffering, and that's going to be a real problem. So going forward in 2019, there's little to cheer about it in Canada. We got NAFTA, we've seen our Canadian dollar rally, but Len, what this means is that in 2019, it's very unlikely the Bank of Canada will be able to match the U.S. Fed in their rate risings toe-to-toe. We got a big problem, which is $1.70 of debt for every dollar of income in this country compares to just $1 of debt for a dollar of income in the United States. So we're going to have a tough time with rising rates. So it does have investment implications, and, you know, Canadian banks are down about 2.5% this year. Why don't we own Canadian banks? I think it's an ugly story, and I'm glad we don't own them because I don't like to lose money, but I think it's an ugly story in 2019 because I think you're going to have some get-backs and some foreclosures starting to emerge early next year.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Great.
Thank you.
All right. Next, we have a question from Bruce Alexander. Please go ahead.
Hi, David. Actually, the previous question was precisely mine anyway, so you don't have to repeat it. But it's good to hear the confirmation. I'm assuming what happens in Vancouver happens ahead of Toronto, but Toronto itself is leveraged and probably will get hit a bit badly as well.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Good work.
Thanks.
All right. And the last question we currently have in the queue comes from Bob. Please go ahead, Bob.
Hi, David. Bob Seaman. Thanks for your excellent presentation. You mentioned that the yield curve has not inverted, but the information and the analyses that you presented today, does that give us any indication as to when and if that might happen?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. There's two scenarios. One was that five-year rates were going to stay where they were and that the Fed was going to keep raising rates, and that could have inverted the curve as early as the spring of next year. The more likely scenario is the five-year rates would rise, and so the earliest inversion, if they stay where they are today and don't rise further. I mean, the weird part of it is, if you don't invert the curve, you're just going to rise inflation, and you're going to be better in stocks. So, you know, the best-performing stock market in the world this year is Venezuela. Why? Because they haven't inverted the curve, but it's up 66,000%. The bad news is inflation is 340% on its way to 1,000,000%. So, you know, if you don't invert the curve, you could keep going for another couple of years, or maybe you never invert the curve. Maybe you just let inflation get to 15% and you just don't keep it in check. If Donald Trump was chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, we would never invert the curve and we'd just have higher and higher inflation and just keep it rocking. You know, I was in Argentina once on a bicycle trip, and, you know, the borrowing rate was 19%, and it was a no-brainer to borrow as much as you could at that rate because inflation was 40. If you bought a refrigerator, the used fridge would be worth more than what your payments were. So, you know, if U.S. interest rates have just gone positive from a real perspective. U.S. inflation at 2.5, and we have interest rates of 3.25 on a 10-year, 3.06 on a 5-year. That means you get a smidge of real. The normalized rate is 2. I mean, I think rates have to go higher, and I think that's going to be a problem. But I don't know. That's a long-winded answer. I think it's way too early to say. I would just rather react to the inversion than say it'll invert by this date. But we are late in this economic cycle. Let's be very clear about it. So anyway, operator, I think I've probably gone, that's my 30 minutes, and it's an important call because I think it's a watershed moment in financial history, and stay tuned. We will be reactive rather than maybe giving you exactly what the forecast is. So thanks very much. I hope to talk to you all soon.
Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes the Lepoid Bank Group conference call. Thank you for your participation and have a nice day.